AccessCast, an Accessibe initiative, presents Unstoppable Mindset, the podcast where inclusion, diversity, and the unexpected meet. Hi, I'm Michael Hinkson, Chief Vision Officer for Accessibe and the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, Thunderdog, the story of a blind man, his guide dog, and the triumph of trust. Thanks for joining me on my podcast as we explore our own blinding fears of inclusion, unacceptance, and our resistance to change. We will discover the idea that no matter the situation or the people we encounter, our own fears and prejudices often are our strongest barriers to moving forward. The Unstoppable Mindset podcast is sponsored by Accessibe, that's AccessibE. Visit www.accessibe.com to learn how you can make your website accessible for persons with disabilities and to help make the internet fully inclusive by the year 2025. Glad you dropped by. We're happy to meet you and to have you here with us. Yep, it is that time again. Welcome to Unstoppable Mindset. I'm Michael Hinkson, your host. Glad to be here. Hope you are happy to be here. Probably are because you're here, right? So wherever you are, welcome. And we really appreciate you and hope that you enjoy the next hour. We have a fascinating guest. We're actually starting the recording of this podcast 10 minutes late because we've just been sitting here chatting. Champa Bakshi is a woman very involved in tech. She has formed a company called Converge Hub, and she actually Converge Hub is a software, well, not a software product specifically, but it is a customer resource management tool. And she'll tell us about that. So I don't want to mess up my description more than I have, but she's also formed a company called CoreLinks, which is a system by which she helps other customers write software and do things that they need to do to make their company work the way it should. And she has a great amount of experience in the world of computer science. She's been involved in Silicon Valley tech for a while. She has a master's degree in computer science. We're jealous. And lots of other things. So Champa, welcome to Unstoppable Mindset after all of that.
Hello, Michael. Thank you. I'm glad to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
And you notice that I didn't use Queen of the World, which I said I could use. And
yes, and thank you for that too.
You're safe. Well, I really am fascinated to learn. Let's start with more about you and what you did growing up and how you got to the point of being so interested and involved in tech.
Yeah, of course. I actually started software programming in college. And initially, I always had an interest in science. And my initial interest, I wanted to go into nuclear physics. So physics was my first love. And then
good subject. My master's degree is in physics.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. So I have a bachelor's in physics, and then I went on to do a master's in computer science. So wonderful. Yeah, it's a really great subject. It's fascinating.
That's fair.
Yeah. And but then, you know, when I, you know, went, I just started taking some computer courses. And once I wrote my first software program, I was totally hooked. And the main reason I really liked it is because it gave me this ability to take a complex problem and then kind of, you know, break it down into little bits and then solve it and kind of, you know, put the solution back together again. So I really, really was interested in that. And then, you know, that was a time when computers as a career, it was just opening up. It was just beginning. And I wasn't thinking so much as career itself, but more in terms of it was really fun, because in that time, when you go into a career, most of the time you could only influence a certain amount of people, right? You know, only the people around you. But what I realized is using computers, you could build a program with somebody sitting on the other corner of the world used to solve his problem, which you probably won't even think about. And just that idea of being able to touch people whom you don't even know, you know, whom you haven't heard of, it was so fascinating to me that I had to get into that, and I had really to do it. So, and even today, even though I don't write software code anymore, but just that idea of building software products, which people all over the world use to solve their problems, it's really interesting to me. I feel like I'm touching their lives.
There you go. Well, what do you do specifically today?
Well, today I'm the CEO of Converge Hub. So I'm a jack of all trades really in the company. So I'm handling the product development. I do oversee that. I do some marketing and even the other financial stuff that I have to do on a daily basis. So
not boring stuff.
Yeah, exactly. But very necessary.
Yes. Yeah. It is part of what has to be done. And at least I don't know whether you have the patience or not, but you certainly seem to be able to put up with it all.
Not always, but I try.
Does your coding experience help you in doing all the other things that you have to do in the company? Or maybe a better question would be, how does that past experience help you?
That's actually very interesting. Now that I think about it, it really does, because when you are coding, you are taught to kind of look at a problem, I kind of step away from it and just look at it as a problem and then start breaking it down, tinkering with it. You know that as a challenge itself, you cannot solve the whole thing. But when you break it down and you address it one by one, you are able to solve it, and you without really getting too involved with taking a step back. So if you take that approach to any other work that you have to do, any other experience or challenge that you're going through, I think that really helps you solve it in a better way.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking that you would say. I remember when I was in undergraduate physics, and of course it then followed on, but in undergraduate physics, oftentimes professors would say, pay attention to the details. It's all about the details. It isn't just the math, for example, it's the units. And if the units don't work out,
right,
then you probably are doing something wrong. So you really need to look at the details. And I've always felt that background in physics, even though I am not doing anything specifically in physics, the background has helped a great deal for me in everything that I do, because I've learned to pay attention to a lot of the details and appreciate the value in doing that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's what it is. And I had read somewhere that education is what survives after what you learned has been forgotten. So I guess that's what it is. It kind of builds into you, and then you keep using it in other experiences in your life.
Yeah, I've talked to a number of people on this podcast who say the reoccurring theme is you should never stop learning.
Absolutely. I totally agree about that.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things that one needs to do. Well, you went off where'd you get your master's from, by the way?
Oh, I did my master's from India.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you came over here at some point.
Yes.
And you started working. Now, did you code when you first came over, or what brought you over here?
Yeah. So in India, after I did my master's, I started working in a company, and that company was then deploying some software programmers here. So I came as a part of that, and I literally landed in US with less than $150 or so, and a job, of course, and went from there. So after I worked, initially I started working with the large enterprises like Cisco Systems, Pyramid Technologies, which was a part of Siemens. And I was doing programming in Cisco Systems. I was part of the sales, the customer facing side of the software, really, the sales, customer service. And in those days, there was no such thing as customer relationship management software. It didn't even exist. So what we were doing is we were taking Oracle applications, the ERP package, and we were customizing it to build those pieces in. And Cisco eventually, it became the first company who I did the online ordering, the entire online ordering, where an order from a customer would go in and to be fulfilled without the touch of a human hand. So, and this was very, very early days. And I was really fortunate to be a part of that big whole team.
What time frame was that?
So this was kind of mid to late 90s, actually. Okay. Late 90s, great. Yeah. 98, 99 kind of time frame.
Yeah.
So, and then after that, I started working on a few startups, but then always wanted to open my own company. So that's when I launched CoreLinks. And well, as a part of CoreLinks, what we do is we build custom software. We are a software strategy firm. So we provide, like a fractional CTO services, strategy services, software development for both products as well as software applications. So, and we did that. And even while we were doing that, kind of noticed that a lot of the requests that we were getting for building the software centered around the same thing about customer relationship management. How do I handle my customers? How do I support my customers? How do I do lead management? So we were building, constantly building software for that for all our clients. And it began to occur to me, I started digging in and found out that really, there was no product in the market which suffice that need for customers. There were really two types of customer relationship products in the market at that time. One was really huge, big, large scale software. You need a PhD to implement that. And other than that, there was these small little contact management systems, really dumbed down products, which really didn't suffice the need of small and medium businesses, because they had their complex processes. But at the same time, they couldn't spend that kind of money, to implement such a large scale software. So that's why we decided to build Converge Hub, which would service these kind of customers. And so we started building Converge Hub, and which is right now a complete customer lifecycle management system. It's right from the beginning of the customer journey till the end is supported within Converge Hub.
So is it a web-based system then, or?
Yes, it is a SaaS product, software as a service product. And right. Yes, it's completely online.
Cool. How does it, so now we have other things like Salesforce and so on. How does it compare with those kinds of products, which of course didn't exist back in the early days?
Yes. Now, when I was working in those, Cisco and those other large enterprises, Salesforce didn't exist. By the time I had founded Converge Hub, Salesforce did start up, but Salesforce was in that category of a large scale software which needs a lot of effort to implement, which small right. businesses didn't necessarily have. So, yeah. So Converge Hub is in the same space, does similar things, but in a much more simpler way, so that you can get that you are able to establish, you are able to serve your complex business processes, but you really didn't have to put in so much effort to implement them. The implementation is much simpler.
I remember when selling tape backup products for Quantum Corporation and others before it and so on, working with Wall Street. Of course, they used both Oracle and Sybase was very unformatted fields and so on. Right. But those firms essentially created their own software within those database structures to do the same kind of work in terms of managing customers, managing orders, managing all of the things related to that. And the Securities Exchange Commission required it, of course, of Wall Street, because they needed you to have a way where you track all your orders, which Wall Street firms would want to do anyway, and then to keep them for 7 years offsite. So we provided the tape backup products, and they would work with products like Elgato and other kinds of tools that would communicate between their systems and the backup products that we provided. So a lot of moving parts.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's come a long way since then, but it's always fun to think back to how quickly we have changed, how much.
Yeah, as I was saying to somebody not too long ago, I remember when a disk crash was a real disk crash.
Yes.
where you had a 16-inch platter and the head was micro centimeters above it. And if it fell, it was a very noisy situation and all your data was lost. Was pretty amazing. So we've come a long way and we'll continue to. That's what kind of makes this technology era fun.
Exactly.
On the other hand, even with you starting in India and so on, tell me a little bit about how women were viewed in tech. And I would think that you were kind of a breakthrough person to deal with some of that.
Yeah, actually, when I started in college, when I went into software, we didn't have that many, you know, women in technology at that time. But it's not like I faced a lot of resistance to it, but there just weren't that many. Software was a very new subject at the time. But then I was so fascinated with it, I wasn't really looking at the gender. I just wanted to build software. So I wasn't really looking at, you know, how many, you know, how easy or hard it would be for me to get in.
Right.
Or, you know. But yeah, since then, even after coming, you'd be surprised though, even after coming into Silicon Valley, I did face some challenges there. It's not so much as, I don't think people really resist you because, you know, you're a woman. It's not that people say that, okay, you know, she's a woman. I'm not going to, you know, listen to what she does. I'm not going to, you know, give credit or, and I'm going to cause resistance. Not really, but it's more sort of a mindset. There's this assumption kind of a thing that you probably aren't as good. You know, you probably won't be able to do it. And then, you know, you have to keep proving yourself all the time. So, and then, you know, it's when you prove yourself, it's not that people won't accept it. You know, people do. So I would think it's more a matter of just education and getting used to it rather than actively you know, making sure, you know, women don't get a chance.
But I think that's true of people who are different than what is viewed as the norm in general. I mean, in terms of blindness, for example, there's resistance, and the general assumption is that if you're blind, you can't succeed nearly as well as sighted people can. And that view has been around for a while. It does take a lot of educating, and you do have to continuously prove yourself to be able to accomplish tasks and grow in the industry. It isn't that you can't, but it certainly tends to be harder because, as you said, it's the mindset of what people believe you can and can't do. And unfortunately, in the case of, well, and in some ways with women too, but in the case of blind people, for example, the unemployment rate among employable blind people is still in the area around 70%. And it's not because people who are blind, who happen to be blind, can't work. It's that others think they can't work, and that prejudice still exists.
Oh, I totally, you know, get that. And, you know, interestingly, I had an encounter which this was a while ago. I was in college at the time, and I was kind of, you know, I think I had gone down for some internship, returning home. No, got down from the bus, and there was this, you know, blind person who had traveled with us, who also kind of, you know, got down from the bus, and there was this road to cross, and he was looking around, and he asked for help. He said, "Can somebody please help me cross the road?" And the bus was full of people, so many people had unboarded the bus, but it was kind of really strange that although he was asking, and he was asking confidently, but people were hearing it. Obviously, they were hearing it. They were sort of pretending not to hear it and you know, going their own way. And it took me by surprise, not just the people's reaction, but even that person's reaction, because he was very confident. He was not, there was no kind of, he was not submissive. He was not even, you know, although he was asking for help, he was doing it so confidently. I thought it was the other side, the people who should have been more confident probably were not confident. They didn't even have the confidence to step forward and just help him cross the road. So I watched that for a little while, and then I decided to step up. So I went to him, I said, "Okay, come on." I took his hand and I just helped him cross the road. I asked if, you know, he wanted help just getting home. And he said, oh, no, I live close by. I can manage from here. I just needed help crossing the road. And he just went about his way confidently. You couldn't even tell that he was blind unless, you know, you actually looked at his stick. So that experience really stayed with me that really, you know, this person was so confident. Why was it all he needed was a little bit of help? You know, why wouldn't, you know, anybody do that?
Chris, the other thing that would be helpful is he could figure out how to cross the road. I mean, I used to live in Winthrop, Massachusetts, and every day, both going to the bus and getting off the bus coming home, we had a bus stop that was across the road from the entrance to my apartment complex. And it was just in the middle of the road, right? So there wasn't like a major street that the bus stopped at. There was a bus stop and it was right in the middle of the street. Mm-hmm. And there are tools to use. It was a little bit daunting until I figured out that, hey, one thing I can do to cross the road is to follow other people and listen to them as they are crossing. And the other is to wait until the bus leaves so it's quieter and then listen to traffic. And when I don't hear traffic coming across in front of me for at least a little bit of period of time and I don't hear anything that sounds like it's close, then to go across the road. But it is a process. And it can be scary, but it can be daunting if you really don't learn to do that. So I'm a little bit curious why he had some issues with being able to cross the road, and perhaps he didn't have enough hearing to be able to do that. Who knows?
Oh, actually, I think I know. It's probably because, you know, this was in India, and it's so loud and so noisy and so much traffic going on all the time.
And there was no lull in the noise.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So that was very, very chaotic and very, very noisy the entire time. So he couldn't use noise as a marker.
He couldn't use noise as a, So the only thing he could possibly do, if he could hear it, is to just listen to other people. And as they're going across, stay right behind them. But still, it's an issue. Did he use a cane or anything like that?
Yeah, he used a cane.
Good. That would certainly help. But, you know, everyone is different. And certainly the noise factor is a big issue. I've been in New York on street corners where there are well-defined crosswalks and well-defined ways to go. But it's so noisy that it's even hard to hear the traffic going the way I want to go. And, you know, what we do is we listen. And when the traffic is going the way we want to go, then we cross. But sometimes the noise can be so loud around us that even that's hard to hear.
Yes.
So there are always challenges.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean that we can. And that's part of the problem, is that sometimes people would go, well, you just could never do that because you're blind. Well, I can, but, you know, let's talk about the sun being in your eyes and how well you're able to see when the sun's coming right at you. You know, we all have challenges.
Yes, of course.
So good for you for helping.
Oh, sure. Thank you.
But it is an issue, and it is a challenge that we have. Well, so you went off and you got your master's degree in computer science and you came over to the U.S. That must have been, maybe the way I would put it, is quite an adventure, huh? Just getting here and all.
Oh, yes, it was.
Totally new for you.
Yes, it was absolutely new for me. And then, getting into a tech industry, an immigrant, brown woman, you know, starting to work in the tech industry, it wasn't easy. But then, you learn as you go. It was, you know, there are challenges, you know, you start looking at. And then there are challenges and then there are solutions. You know, it's, you know, people do help out. And it's just, if I think a lot of it is also about how much you like the subject and how hard you're willing to work. And if you have that, I think all other challenges, you know, you'll probably be able to work out.
But you had a mindset that you were going to work it out. You were going to try to do that as opposed to letting it all overwhelm you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's, I think it's also a little bit about being able to know that, yes, you will be able to do it. You know, ultimately, it's going to work out. Maybe you can just try to look a little bit into the future and say, you know, here I am going to do it. This is just a process, you know, just a few challenges, which I will have to go through. Everybody has their own challenges. These are mine.
Yeah. And that's the real point, isn't it? Everyone has their own challenges. And
exactly.
And challenges aren't the same for everyone.
Absolutely. Yeah, totally agree.
So you made it over, you started, and you started doing doing technology stuff and all that. So how long was it before you started working essentially for yourself?
I started working for myself around, let's say, 2002, 2003, I think, time frame.
Uh-huh.
So that's when I started kind of consulting, you know, going solo, started working on smaller size project. And a year or so after that, I launched CoreLinks. So that's when, so slowly that grew, you know, we started getting more projects. And then I started having a team. We formed a team in India too. So, and I started off loading some of my work to them, and slowly the team grew. And yeah, so that's how things took off.
What were some of the early projects like that you started and that you used CoreLinks to develop?
Oh, we were always working. In the beginning, we were mostly working on software applications or interesting one was in the insurance industry. I remember this was way back, but you know, we were kind of, you know, comparing different insurance products, and you know, this was for car insurance, if I remember correctly, and it was really advanced for its time too. And we were kind of, you know, giving, there were some hundreds of points on which, you know, you could compare insurances. So usually when you're reading at insurance, you don't even look at the fine print. And this was a kind of a technology which would help you compare insurance without really having to look at the fine print. So that was one. There was another one for the fintech industry that we were building the entire end-to-end process for fintech. So yeah, some very interesting projects we did in the beginning.
What kind of language or coding did you use to develop those?
At that time, we were using PHP, and we used MySQL as a database.
Yeah, SQL servers and all that.
True. Yeah.
Yeah. What do you use now? How's it evolved over the years?
Yeah, now, although I'm not coding anymore, but my team uses...
But your team, like, yes.
Yeah. Uses Node. We use Angular. So yeah, there's MongoDB we use. So a lot, it's changed significantly. Even the way you code has changed significantly. It's a lot more modular. And at that time we used to write, you know, thousands of line of codes, a lot of very, very monolithic kind of code. Now it's so much more modular. It's distributed. So things have changed completely, but it's kind of fun to watch my team. Although, you know, yeah, I don't get that involved into the day-to-day process anymore.
But you have enough and you keep up with it. So you could, if you needed to, be involved in the process, I would assume.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, I still have my, you know, kind of, you know, hand in there. I have daily meetings with the team. But right now, my perspective is more from that of a user, from that of a, you know, customer, how the customer experience, what will a user go through. So that's my perspective rather than, wow, this is cool. You know, this is a nice bit of technology. Let's use it. I don't think of it like that anymore.
But it's good to be able to take the user perspective, and it's good to have that in a company, because then you really get to understand it from the standpoint of those who are going to be directly involved with and encounter your products, as opposed to just creating them and pushing them out the door without having that understanding, I would think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's somehow you mature, because in the beginning, that's how you kind of, you know, especially from a tech background, you kind of, you know, think, you know, tech is cool. And so just try to use anything. And I see my team still trying to do that. I have to push back on it, just because it's the user who is the most important person here. And, you know, whatever that takes, and technology is cool as long as it's serving the customer. And really, I would say, you know, we are coming up with a new release of Converge Hub. And what we are trying to do here, you know, I'm really trying to put in the human perspective into it more than anything else. Because from my experience in the software industry from a very long time, what I'm seeing is there is really no B2B or B2C or, you know, anything like that anymore. It's really a matter of a human being using your product. It's a person using your product, you know, whatever else, you know, from whomever to whomever, it's still ultimately a person using it. So that kind of knowledge really comes with experience. And that's what, how we are building Converge Hub. So our idea is that, you know, using Converge Hub, you know, sales and marketing and customer service, all that is wonderful. And our users will be doing all of that. The features are there. But more so what we would like our user to do is to be able to use the product to, you know, make a difference. So, you know, he is able to make a difference right where he is at. You know, whatever he or she is doing, he should be able to do it better, do it in such a way that, you know, maybe do it quicker and do it to build, you know, better businesses and I hope better communities. Ultimately.
One would hope.
Yes.
So when did you, if you will, graduate from CoreLinks and so on to Converge Hub, although you do both, but when did Converge Hub first come into existence?
Converge Hub's release was, the first release was somewhere around, I think we started getting customers around 2017 or so, although it was released a little bit earlier in the market, around 2016, but that's when it was the very first release. We started ironing out all the bugs. I'm a bit of a perfectionist, so I didn't really wanted to push and sell the product until the bugs were ironing out, all the features were built in. So then we started, you know, getting customers in the 2016, 2017 time frame, and it went from there. And now we are getting into the next release, the next version of Converge Hub.
I will bet, however, that no matter how much you did to perfect it and iron out all the bugs, that once you actually released it, your users started finding things that you guys didn't discover.
Oh, yeah. You would bet correctly. You would win that bet. So, yes, there were... And I think software is basically a work in progress. You know, you can never have 100% perfect software. By the time you have the bugs ironed out, there are more features you're building it, and those new features will have some bugs. It's always work in progress. No company, no software ever built has 100% everything, all bugs ironed out, but you try. And what you do really hope is that the bugs that you do still have aren't hampering the main activities of your users. So if it's, you know, really hampering their productivity, if it's not letting them do what they would like to do in the software, that's when it takes priority. And that's how we prioritize bugs too, you know, which ones to fix first, which ones to kind of put on the back burner.
You're in California, right? You're in the Silicon Valley.
Yes.
So you watch some of the same TV commercials that I do, if you watch TV at all. And actually, I saw it again this morning. There is someone who has been putting out some commercials that are just slamming Tesla because they say that the autonomous vehicle software in Tesla is dangerous and Congress should stop it and so on. And he's made that his primary focus in his Senate campaign. It's fascinating, notwithstanding the fact that Tesla hasn't, as I understand it, at least the last time I checked, released a totally autonomous vehicle version of the software. But the reality is it's always going to be a work in progress to do what Tesla has already done so much of, to make their vehicle work in a way to greatly assist drivers. And it's just fascinating to see that kind of a mindset that just wants to put a stop to all of that kind of stuff when that makes no sense at all.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with you there, because if it's a software, there's always going to be bugs. So that's for sure. But it is true that in certain industries, those bugs have a bigger impact.
Correct.
Because if you are not careful, you know, when you're driving a car, a bug could, you know, injure somebody, you know, or worse. But at the same time, you know, similar to that is medical profession. You know, so anything, any software in the medical profession, you have to test very, very thoroughly because there are human lives involved. But at the same time, at some point, you know, you have to do your best and you have to completely test thoroughly. And I think incrementally, you do have to release the software. Otherwise, it just doesn't happen, right? So, and knowing that it is software and there will be bugs and we just do our level best to make sure that that bug doesn't have the worst kind of impact.
Well, being an equal opportunity abuser, of course, my immediate reaction is, if we're going to talk about what goes on with Tesla, let's talk about people driving in general. And there's some value in replacing them.
Exactly.
I'm amazed at my wife. Now, my wife uses a wheelchair. She uses hand controls and she drives really well. Mm-hmm. We have had one accident in the almost 40 years that we've had a couple, but there was one accident that we were probably more responsible for than anything else. We had one where we were actually going to anniversary dinner and we came over a hill and there was a place where a car should not have been stopped on the road and there was no way to see it ahead of time. But this young lady who was a teenage driver had just stopped in the middle of the road and we bumped her before we could stop. So it was a brand new car and a dent in the car. But we had a time where we were driving and actually a gust of wind kind of blew us over and we brushed against a piece of heavy equipment and then went back across the road. But partly she was also trying to avoid a trailer that had come up on us. She saw the truck that was pulling the trailer, but didn't see the trailer. It was in her blind spot. Well, anyway, but she dealt with it. But there are so many people on the road that are so impatient, drive so aggressively, and I don't know how they survive because they don't do anything to recognize the courtesy and the what we used to call in the world defensive driving. You know, we don't do that anymore.
No. Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm all for taking the driving away from drivers and as soon as we can, putting it into a much more autonomous vehicle kind of environment because too many crazy people are out there driving on the road.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. So when once, you know, we get into that autonomous driving becomes the main thing, the research says that they are way safer than just these crazy people or drunk people, you know, driving a car. At least the machine won't do drunk driving, you know.
We are kind of in the forefront of it and we're new into it, but it's going to happen. It has to.
Yes, absolutely. It has to happen.
So there's a lot of artificial intelligence and machine learning that goes into all that. And speaking of that, how does that play into both you and Converge Hub and CoreLinks and so on? Do you use much artificial intelligence to help in the development or testing of your software and so on?
Yes, and it's not so much in the development itself, but we are planning the new version of Converge Hub. We are, you know, planning to put artificial intelligence in there. You know, there's AI to do a lot of automated stuff, which initially would have to be manual. And then, of course, you know, there is so much data analytics, and all of that is going to be built into the new version of Converge Hub. So all the definite features are not ironed out yet, you know, what we are going to give, but there's no one thing for sure is that we are going to have a completely channel-less conversations. So regardless of, you know, like today's users, they could be using, you know, one channel at one point of time and, you know, completely switch channels, you know, the other point of time. So, you know, from email to phone to Twitter to, to texting. So all of these channels should appear as if it's still a conversation, as if it's a one conversation thread going on the whole time. So there is so much insights that you can figure out from those conversations. And, you know, many other companies have started working on it. It's not perfect. Nobody has perfected it, but, you know, we are definitely, you know, going to work on that and see, you know, where that leads us. So for me as a tech person, it's like both ways. You know, one is, of course, you know, this is the latest technology. This is where we are going to be. We have to be there. But the change, the more they remain the same, you know? So it's ultimately, it's about how the technology will help you do a better job, you know, at whatever it is that you're doing. So as long as we can do that, we balance that, you know, that's the ideal way to go, I would say.
Again, we're in a bleeding edge environment where so many of these things are new and we're just learning about them. And in 100 years, it's going to be a totally different world. And then we'll have other things that are new. But Yes. But what we're talking about today as kind of in the formative era will all change.
Yeah. Yeah. And the change is coming faster and faster. You know, it's exciting to see, a little bit scary too. But as time goes by, it's just the pace is accelerating. You know, you don't even know. I mean, why 100 years? We don't really even know what's coming up in the next 5 or 10 years from now. So That's exciting and scary at the same time.
Sometime in the next 100 years, somebody's going to probably develop anti-gravity, and maybe we'll even get Star Trek transporters.
Yes. You know, I'm just waiting for that, you know, beam me up, Scotty.
Yeah, I'm waiting for that. That would certainly take care of a lot of the driving issues,
yes,
wouldn't it?
Yes, that's going to take care of it, absolutely. No more driving. I'd love that.
Oh, yeah, well, we could use the roads for other things. Robert Heinlein wrote a short story called The Roads Must Roll back in the early 1950s, and instead of driving, roads all moved and were long, almost like conveyor belts, and even going from one end of California to the other. It was a fascinating story. It's a really interesting story to read because Everyone used rolling roads to go anywhere. And off of the main roads, there were other roads that rolled that took you where you needed to go. It's a fascinating story.
Yeah. Wow. That's an interesting concept. No? So cars don't need to drive. It's the roads that are doing the driving for you.
Right. You ought to go hunt it. It's called The Roads Must Roll by Robert Heinlein.
I'll definitely look at it. Yes.
It's a short story. You can read it in 15 minutes.
Oh, sure. Then I'm going to look it up. Yep.
Yeah, there you go.
The other day I was reading about another fascinating concept too somewhere, is that, you know, cars start charging themselves as they drive. So, you know, you have some sort of, you know, I don't even know if there's a real roads are going to be built such that, you know, the cars, while they're driving, they get charged. So you really don't need to charge the cars anymore.
I think, I know somewhere in this area around San Diego, I think it is, there was a road that had some sort of cable going through it that helped provide guidance for the car. But I don't remember whether it charged or not. I think it was pre a lot of the electric vehicles. But I wouldn't be surprised if there wouldn't be a way coming along that cars could charge themselves. Of course, there's always solar, but you probably need more than what we can do with solar today on a small car.
Right, exactly. So, yeah, I would say the technology problem, getting it out into the world in a more cost-effective way, building the infrastructure, that would be, you know, the challenging part.
But that's going to be a lot of what happens with software, is it's all about making it more efficient, making it cost-efficient, and getting things out in an efficient way, isn't it?
Yes. That's depends on... how cost-effective we can make it. And in Corelinks, when our clients come in, that's what we tell them too. You know, we can do it very fast. You can build a huge, aeroplane for you, but do you really need that? And how much budget do you have? So we have to build according to your needs and your budget. We do our best work, you know, otherwise everything is possible.
You talk a lot, both about Converge Hub and Corelinks, about efficiency and the importance of that and what you do and what you're bringing to your customers.
Yeah, absolutely. I think efficiency is especially, you know, both in Converge Hub and Corelinks, although, you know, in different ways, but for Converge Hub, it's a matter of, I would say, productivity. So it's not just about what you can do. It's a matter of how well you can do it, how quickly you can do it, and what results you can get, you know, doing it. You know, that's what I would say, you know, makes the software special. Otherwise, it's not about building a lot of features, a lot of, you know, wonderful tools that nobody uses.
Where do you see, we talked about artificial intelligence, but where do you see that, and what other kinds of things do you see coming along in the next 5 or 10 years that you can look at and talk about in terms of how some of the ways we think of software and some of the ways software will interact with our lives are going?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I would say software slowly will stop becoming something that you're kind of, you know, sitting at your desk or even, you know, looking at it on the mobile phone. It's going to become everywhere. It's everything is going to be software. So And right now we do have that, you know, your TV has software, your fridge has software, but it's just going to become such that, and especially, you know, you are going to be able to, like, you know, talk to it. And we do it again, you know, it's all there right now, but it's going to become ubiquitous. It's going to be, you know, your car, your home, your washing machine, and every single thing that you do is going to become software. We won't call it software anymore. I think you'll just call it life. So it's just there. And in terms of technology, if you will, I think voice as a technology, voice activation, talking to your machines, you know, that's going to become, you know, more and more important. The insights that it gives you in terms of, you know, sales software or, you know, customer software that we're looking at. Even now in Next Converge Hub, that's our aim to bring about, is that looking at your past data or whatever work that you're doing, it's telling you a future direction. And again, that efficiency that you talk about, the productivity you talk about. So there are these 100, 200 things that you could do today, but which 10 that you do will bring an impact? Which 10 of those should you focus on to get the maximum impact, the maximum out of your day? So that those kind of insights are going to become important. You know, right now, again, you know, everybody is trying to do it. I won't say, you know, we are where we, you know, at where we should be, but we are getting there. And those are the kind of things that I foresee, you know, happening, other than the fact that, you know, we are going to probably have humanoid kind of, you know, robots whom we are going to interact with. And yeah, who knows? So those are all in the horizon coming up soon.
Of course, you have Ray Kurzweil, who talks about the singularity, the time when computers, if you will, and humans merge, and we, through our brains, can access all of it directly.
Yes, the thought interface, you know, that we sometimes talk about, and those are, I don't know, it's exciting and scary at the same time, right? Just something we can't even think about, but it's slowly creeping upon us. It's happening so slowly, probably, that we are not even noticing, but we are getting there, and we just have to figure out ways and probably even laws to deal with it.
Well, and that's going to be part of it, is the laws and trying to definitely put a standard to it. Do you? But it seems to me, and I mentioned the senator campaign and so on, it strikes me that those kinds of commercials and that kind of a discussion really represents a fear of change and a fear of what these products are really bringing to us, which shouldn't be there, but it still is.
Yeah, absolutely. I would totally agree on that. I think it's more about the fear of the unknown in another form. So you don't really, you know where this is going, which is true. I mean, it's scary. But at the same time, you cannot ignore the enormous amount of value it is adding to our lives. So I would say that the way to, you know, get through this is to, you know, not really ignore it and not to shy away from it and say, hey, you know, Tesla software is buggy, so we never go autonomous, driving way. But to kind of look at it right now and say, what standards should we set? What laws should we set? What is it that we need to do to make sure all of this works out well for us? It doesn't end in disaster. It works out such that, you know, rather than, being seen as a flaw, it's seen as something that saves lives, because autonomous driving ultimately will save lives if done right.
How do we get people to go from where they are to recognizing what you just said, which is the value of a lot of these kinds of improvements? It seems like it's an ongoing battle, but how do we get people to move past no to yes, if you will?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I would say the only way to do it is with education, right? So it's always the fear of unknown, and education is what's going to make that unknown known to you. So the more we can educate people, the more we kind of bring it a little more to the masses and say that, you know, you bring it such that we can, you know, touch and feel it and see there's really nothing to be afraid of. I think the more it works. I remember when I was in Cisco, they had this big lab where they were testing out all these different things. And this was very, very, you know, initial days of, but I remember they were testing out things like technology like you could order milk. You could ask your refrigerator to order milk for you. Or, you know, you could turn on the oven while you're driving home in your car. You could switch on your oven. At that time, that seemed like, oh my goodness, you know, what if my house burns down? Now it doesn't seem so absurd anymore. So it's just a matter of education, how much we have accepted it. And it's a matter of time and education. I think it's a factor of both of them.
Yeah, and how we can get people educated more quickly to be more adventurous. And that's what it really is, right? You came over from India into a pretty unknown situation. And I've experienced some of those things in my life, going from one side of the country to the other with no family and no support system and developing a whole new thing. But life is an adventure. And all too often, we don't think about the fact that it's an adventure and a great learning experience. And if we could get more people to view it that way, we probably would also have a lot less fear, or at least we would be open to exploring new things, even though the fear might be there. Again, it would be something that we can start to work to control.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that, because there is always risk. I mean, even in life, I mean, you don't know, you go out of the home, there is risk, you know, there is always a risk you're facing. But how do you, it's just that somehow, you know, people think there is more risk in the unknown, but, you know, maybe the rewards are greater in the unknown too. You just don't know that. You just have to take that risk to find out what it is all about. And to me, again, I think that's a lot about, I call that the entrepreneurial mindset. And I've recently started talking about this too, because I think the entrepreneurial mindset has that thing to, you know, that spark where you can step up, you can take a little bit of risk, you can look at any challenges and say that, yeah, I'm going to solve this. It's not just about entrepreneurs. It's not that it's just in entrepreneurs. I think it's in it, regardless of what life situation is in, whether you're in a business or whether you are going solo or not. You know, whatever it is that you are doing right now, you can bring that mindset into it and, you know, experiment a little bit, you know, step up into it, take a little bit of risk, you know, learn a little bit more. And that would, I think, would help life become a lot more interesting.
Well, tell me more about that. You are an entrepreneur, obviously, by kind of any standard. But tell me more about your thoughts about being an entrepreneur. How do we get more people to do that? How do we get more people to accept that they can possibly do the same sort of thing?
Yes, sure. Yes, I have, always been an entrepreneur, I think, because I come from a family of entrepreneurs, and I always wanted to have my own company. And so it's more so because I love to build things, you know, whether it's a product, whether it's a company. I like to kind of, you know, see the little bits coming together to form a whole and then impacting, getting bigger than yourself. It becomes, you know, initially when you're looking at it, you know, it's a vision, it's completely within you, nobody else can see it. But slowly when it comes out into the world and then goes out into the world, it becomes so much, so many other people get involved. You know, they start sharing your vision and it becomes so much bigger than yourself. So I think it's just a matter of, if somebody would like to become entrepreneur, and I think there are everyday entrepreneurs who don't necessarily have to or have a company. They don't necessarily have to have, go solo or, you know, have their own startups, raise venture capital. I think entrepreneurs are whoever are willing to step up. I think in there's this book called, I think, if I'm not mistaken, the name is Daring Greatly by Brené Brown. And she tells it really well, where you are kind of into the arena, where you're willing to go into the arena and, you know, face off your challenges. So that thought process, I would think, is more about becoming an entrepreneur than anything else. So if I think you are ready to take on responsibility, ready to learn new things, that mindset is what, you know, people need to bring in.
What excites you about going to work every day?
Oh, that's a really nice question. I think, you know, what really excites me is that I have the tool to make a difference, that I can, you know, structure my day in such a way and build things that at someday will, you know, probably, you know, touch somebody's life with And especially probably will touch with somebody's life, even when, you know, I don't know about it. So that's why I, you know, often love hearing about, you know, Converge Hub from users, when users reach out to me saying, you know, how do I solve this problem? Or, hey, I used it, you know, in this particular case and it worked. Or even saying that, you know, if you just improve this thing a little bit, it will help do this. So it's just kind of, you know, people have taken something that, no, we visualized, which was this small, and they are using it in their own, doing their own thing, which is completely different from what we visualized, and it still works. So that's really exciting, you know, how I'm able to touch people's life and improve their life, if you will, in whatever little way.
You know, a lot of people say, well, it's all about making money. We got to be more, we're successful because we make more money, but I'm not hearing you say that's the biggest priority.
It's really never been that, really. It's never been that, because if so, I would probably go out. I'm here in the Silicon Valley. We started our company pretty early in the day, would have gone out, raised a lot of capital, you know, gone the IPO route and, you know, done that, you know, made a lot of money. But it's a little more, you know, complex than that to me. So I would like to, you know, go in my own pace, do my own thing, you know, make my own, you know, mark in the world.
You mentioned Brené Brown and her book. Have you thought about writing a book?
I actually have, yes.
Ah.
So I have thought about it a lot of times, haven't, you know, found the time yet, but someday I'm going to write a book.
You have a lot of insights that I think people would like to hear, which is one of the reasons I thought it would be great to have you on this podcast. But you do have a lot of insights that I think would inspire people and motivate people. And the lessons that you have learned and the things that you teach to your employees and your customers are all valuable insights that I would think would make a fascinating book. And of course, I have written 2 books and working on our third now, talking about fear. But I am a firm believer in something that you said, which is it's all about telling stories too. So it isn't just preaching at people, it's using stories to illustrate what you talk about. And you've told a number of those stories in what we're doing here, which I think is great, because it really shows in real life examples what's happening.
Great. Yeah. Thank you, Michael. I really, really appreciate that. You know, I'm so thankful you said that, because it's been on my mind for a long time. I would love to share my experiences in a book. I love writing too. So it's one of my passions. And if I find the time, when I find the time, I do have a blog though. So I write very short blogs, whatever I can manage. But someday, hopefully I'll be able to sit down and, you know, narrate these experiences.
And do you do videos or any other ways of communicating with people outside?
I recently started doing that. Yesterday I put out my first video on LinkedIn, and I'm planning to do that more and more, because what I'm seeing is that's another different medium for, you know, somebody who is not that fond of reading to still be able to go out and, put your ideas forward in front of that person. So I intend to do that more and more.
What was your first video about?
Entrepreneurship.
Oh, of course.
I was actually talking about what it means to be an entrepreneur, believe it or not. So that was one topic very fresh on my mind when I started talking about it today.
Well, and it makes perfect sense. And again, I think as you work toward a book, and you can always get people to help do some of the writing of it just to save time or free up some of yours. But in the books that I've written, I've worked with 2 writers, and I'm working with a third professional writer in the book that we're writing now. The working title of it is A Guide Dog's Guide to Being Brave, because we're talking about controlling fear, which is, of course, what happened to me on September 11th, being in the World Trade Center and escaping. It was all about, for me, knowing in advance what to do in the case of an emergency and being as prepared as one could be, which kept the fear away. I was certainly always concerned about what might happen while we were going down the stairs, because there was fire above us. We had no idea it was an airplane or anything that hit the building at the time. None of us did. It wasn't a blindness issue, but clearly something was very seriously wrong. And at the same time, the preparation that I had made in advance was very helpful. And so we finally decided during the pandemic to write about that. And so I'm working with a writer, Carrie Wyatt Kent, and we're putting the book together. And what I find is that She does a lot of the writing. I do a lot of the writing, but I also, because we want to put it in my story, even then take what she writes and tweak it some. But it's still a whole lot less time than if I did it all. So it's another way to go. But for me, it does help to get the message out there, to put it in a book form, and people have appreciated what we've written so far. So I guess it's a good thing.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And your story is so, so inspiring. I've read about it in your website. I do plan to, you know, get your book and read all about it, you know, in more detail. But, you know, what you went through and how, you know, with your dog, it's very, very inspiring story.
Yeah, what people often miss is that it's a team effort. The dog has a job to do and I have a job to do. That the dog doesn't lead, the dog guides, and there's a big distinct difference between those two. But Thunder Dog is the title of the book, and it is out there, and I think that it helps to teach people a lot about what blindness is really like as opposed to what we think it is. And it's the usual myth that people have misconceptions, whether it's about blindness or technology or whatever. It is all about education and getting people to move forward and recognize that maybe we have the wrong idea about what this is about.
Yeah, yeah, I absolutely am going to read your book. And do you know when your new book is coming out? Did you set a date yet?
The tentative date is, by the time all is done, we get it edited and everything else is going to, it's a ways away yet, probably in the probably in the second quarter of 2024. So it's not going to be soon.
It's been a while. Yeah, it's going to be a while, but I'm looking forward to it already. Definitely going to read that one too.
Well, we were blessed to get a contract signed with a publisher. And so we're working with their time frame. We've talked about when to publish it and why to publish it then. So I think it'll be kind of fun. But we, at this point, there's Thunderdog and Running with Roselle. So definitely get them. And Running and Thunderdog especially is also available in audio format, which is an easy way to get it if you do much driving.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Even in an autonomous vehicle.
I need an autonomous vehicle for that. But I just love reading. So I'm definitely going to get that. And your book was a bestseller too, right?
Yeah, it was a number one New York Times bestseller. Again, we were very blessed with that. So
that's impressive.
We like that. Well, Shampa, I'm going to let you go back to doing some of the creative things that you do. We've been talking for an hour and it's been fun.
Really? It's been an hour already?
I know. Isn't that fun?
Yeah, and you are welcome. So much fun.
You are welcome to come back anytime if you want to talk further. I would love to do that. And definitely, I want to stay in touch. I love what you had to say about artificial intelligence and so on. And I'm glad that you did check out Accessibe. We talked about that very briefly. It's also a bleeding edge type of technology.
It is. Yes, it was. I was very impressed with it. I did take a look at it and I look forward to talking to them again.
Well, we'll help facilitate that. And anytime that we can be of help, and if you want to talk more to folks here, don't hesitate. We can even use some of these to podcast to help with your book.
Oh, yeah, that would be wonderful. Thank you so much, Michael. Thank you for that idea. It's been a pleasure talking to you. It's been a lot of fun.
I've enjoyed it very much. And I hope all of you who are listening have enjoyed it. Wherever you are, hope that you enjoyed the last hour. If you would like, I want to hear from you. But before I give you my contact information, Shampa, how can people find you and maybe learn more about what you're doing and about Converge Hub and so on?
Yeah, I have a blog. I write pretty regularly in there. So you could read my blog. It's thespark.work. So thespark, one word, .work.
Thespark,
T-H-E-S-P-A-R-K. T-H-E-S-P-A-R-K.work.
.work, right. Yes. Okay.
And you could follow me on LinkedIn. You know, I'm very active there. And also my email address is Shampa, S-H-A-M-P-A, at convergehub.com. So any of these methods work, just reach out to me.
And we are all going to be anxiously awaiting your book someday.
Thank you for your encouragement, Michael. Now I have to write a book.
There you go. Well, again, wherever you are, thanks for listening. If you'd like to reach out and talk about today's podcast, I would love to hear from you. You can reach me at Michael H.I. MICHALHI at accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled ACCESSIBE.com. Or you can go to our podcast page, www.michaelhingson, MICHALHINGSON.com/podcast. And by the way, since we mentioned Accessibe, you can even see Accessibe on the site and learn more about it. Also, I would definitely appreciate you giving us a 5-star rating when you finish today. Please rate the podcast. I hope that you found it enjoyable and interesting and that you will give it a 5-star rating. So thanks for listening. And Champa, again, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Michael. It was wonderful talking to you.
Thanks very much. You have been listening to the Unstoppable Mindset Podcast. Thanks for dropping by. I hope that you'll join us again next week and in future weeks for upcoming episodes. To subscribe to our podcast and to learn about upcoming episodes, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/podcast. Michael Hingson is spelled MICHALHINGSON. While you're on the site, please use the form there to recommend people who we ought to interview in upcoming editions of the show. And also, we ask you and urge you to invite your friends to join us in the future. If you know of anyone or any organization needing a speaker for an event, please email me at speaker@michaelhingson.com. I appreciate it very much. To learn more about the concept of blinded by fear, please visit www.michaelhingson.com/blinded by fear. And while you're there, feel free to pick up a copy of my free ebook entitled Blinded by Fear. The Unstoppable Mindset Podcast is provided by AccessCast, an initiative of Accessibe, and is sponsored by Accessibe. Please visit www.accessibe.com. Accessibe is spelled A-C-C-E-S-S-I-B-E. There you can learn all about how you can make your website inclusive for all persons with disabilities and how you can help make the internet fully inclusive by 2025. Thanks again for listening. Please come back and visit us again next week.